these platforms are being used by people who wish us harm and wish to undercut our way of life. So, to those who wish to undermine the American way of life, they found portals into our society that are intermingled with everyday life, and the challenge of this hearing and of this focus is to how do we keep the good and deal with the bad.
South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham kicking off a Senate hearing on social media and how it influenced the 2016 election. Just days after the election, Mark Zuckerberg shrugged off the idea that fake news on Facebook influenced voters. It took the company until September to admit a Russian troll farm bought ads on its platform. Earlier this month, Facebook said an estimated 10 million users had seen ads bought by Russian accounts. Today, Facebook is telling Congress the number is more like 126 million users. It's not just Facebook. Top executives from Facebook, Google, and Twitter are testifying on the Hill today and tomorrow about how many millions of users saw Russian bot ads and what they're doing to prevent this from happening again. Will Oremus writes about technology and the media for Slate, and he joins me now. Hi, Will.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, I've been trying to figure out if any of these ads were in my feed, and I'm not sure if they were or not. What did they look like?
Well, that's actually one of the questions and one of the reasons that these companies are on Capitol Hill today, testifying in front of the House of Representatives, and tomorrow they'll testify before a Senate committee. They haven't disclosed these ads for the most part. We don't know exactly what they looked like. What we do know is that some of the Facebook ads were actually sort of posts. They looked less like the kind of ad you would see on TV and more like a meme that you would see in your Facebook newsfeed. And the Russian-linked groups were paying to promote them. And often they were trying to push some kind of divisive message. So they were posing as, for instance, Black Lives Matter activists and pretending to espouse really extreme views in order to upset people on the other side of the political spectrum.
So just as a regular user, you would not necessarily think, oh, this is an ad, or, oh, this is not a real user, this is something fake.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of times it was propaganda in the form of either fake news or some other kind of politically motivating content that was being pushed out there.
All right. And one of the main companies from Russia is known as, it's called the Internet Research Agency, and that's a Kremlin-linked organization.
Yeah, and that they've been behind a lot of this. And it's always possible that there is more to the scope of this problem than we know of. The Internet Research Agency is one of the groups, one of these sort of shadowy groups that all of the big companies so far have homed in on, and they've been looking for links to them.
All right, so why is Facebook upping the numbers from 10 million earlier this month to now 126 million, and could that go even higher?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's one of the things that is a cause for concern here. When they came out with that 10 million figure, it sounded low to a lot of people. It can be hard to measure because, again, these ads aren't just shown to a set number of people. A lot of times it's a post that's posted on Facebook by some kind of page, and then a bunch of people view it, and then they pay for even more people to view it, and then those people can share it with their friends. So the audience for some of this content is actually very hard to measure, and it could be even wider than we've learned so far.
Okay. And so here they are. They're going to try to explain themselves before senators and members of Congress. What's at stake for these three companies in these hearings?
There's a lot at stake here. There's not a lot that scares these companies. These are big, powerful companies. But the idea of the U.S. government coming down with heavy-handed regulation of the way they do business is a big deal to them. If you think about Facebook, its unofficial motto for a long time was move fast and break things. It's all about experimenting. Let's try this. Let's try that. Let's test them against each other. Let's see what works. That is the ethos that has built Facebook and some of these other tech companies into such big forces. Well, if all of a sudden the government turns against them and says, you know what, we think you need to do this in a certain way, and you can't do that, and you can't do the other thing, then that goes out the window, and suddenly these companies are looking less like fast-moving startups and more like big established companies that are constrained in their movements and constrained in their ability to innovate by governmental intervention.
Well, earlier this month, senators from both parties, this was a bipartisan bill, introduced a bill that would require these online political ads to follow the same transparency ads as TV and radio ads. And Twitter has said, OK, well, we'll do that on our own. We don't need any regulation. Is that likely to satisfy people on Capitol Hill?
That will be really interesting to see. We're at a very interesting moment right now. That bill is called the Honest Ads Act. It sounds, a lot of the components of the bill sound very reasonable. And in fact, as you mentioned, Facebook and Twitter have both come out and voluntarily done a lot of what that bill would require them to do. In some cases, they've actually gone further. So the bill would pertain just to political ads. Facebook and Twitter have both now said that they're going to disclose who's paying for all kinds of ads on their platforms. They're really going out of their way to try to say, look, we can do this ourselves. You guys don't need to tell us how to do it. We'll actually go above and beyond if you just let us self-regulate. Now, of course, again, that comes back to this fear that they have. These industries, the tech industry, has enjoyed really lax approach from the federal government so far. It is very concerned that could change. And so I think they really do want to get out ahead of this if they possibly can.
Well, is there anything more that they're afraid of besides having to disclose who buys their ads and who's paying for them? What are they really afraid of in terms of regulation?
That's a great question. I mean, right, they're obviously not just afraid of having to disclose who buys the ads because they're willing to do that already. What they're really afraid of, I think, and the sort of elephant in the room here that's tangential to what's going on today is antitrust. These are massive companies. They really, in some ways, do enjoy monopolistic power over the flow of certain kinds of information in our society. And if you even mention the word antitrust around somebody who works at Google, you know, their face will turn pale. I think that's the underlying long-term concern here, is that they could be treated as potential monopolies and regulated as such.
And is that likely to happen in Europe? They're already talking there about, you know, big fines in the billions.
Yeah, and this has been going on in Europe, and the United States has purposely taken a hands-off attitude to the tech industry on the theory that things move so quickly there that what looks like a monopoly today that has to be broken up could tomorrow be, you know, MySpace. It could have been usurped by some upstart, and the government doesn't want to get in the way of that. The EU has taken a very different approach. They see these companies as already a threat to their democracies, to their civil order in various ways, into individual privacy rights. They've taken a much more active role. And if the United States follows suit, and there's some indication from both sides of the aisle now that there is an appetite on Capitol Hill for a more heavy-handed approach, that could be serious trouble.
Will Remus is the co-host of If Then. That's a new Slate podcast about technology, society, and the future. Will, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mela.
Coming up, how different news organizations are covering the Robert Mueller investigation, with some calling Mueller's credibility into question. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We've been talking about fake news and disinformation on social media. Now let's talk about other media and how they're covering the big news this week, the Mueller investigation and the indictments.
Former Trump campaign officials facing criminal charges in the Russia investigation, two accused of laundering millions of dollars from a Kremlin-friendly government, and another pleads guilty to lying about his contacts with Moscow.
Coverage of yesterday's indictments and guilty plea were everywhere. That's some standard Reuters coverage there. But this is the year 2017, and so your choice of media outlet made a big difference in what you saw.
With the result of the indictment of Paul Manafort and his associate, we will show you right here how there is zero evidence of Trump-Russia collusion, zero evidence of campaign collusion. And in spite of all of that, the media has been lying to you all day and all weekend long.
Sean Hannity from last night on Fox News. We're going to talk about these competing storylines with David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. Hi, David.
Madeline.
What was it like watching TV yesterday? A little whiplash there?
Oh, my goodness. It was sort of a split-screen experience where you had, on the one hand, on, say, CNN and often on MSNBC, the coverage of Washington getting into gear for full scandal, full crisis mode. And you had over on Fox News a different reality, an outrage over the lack of attention being paid, the lack of accountability. What about Hillary Clinton? What about collusion of Democrats? What about scandals with uranium? What about? And the way in which it was really starkest, I've got to say, Dana Perino, the former White House spokeswoman for George W. Bush, who has her own show now in the afternoons on Fox News, interviewed John Roberts, the White House correspondent for Fox, about the day's developments. And he talked about all of the things that the White House had said, ways in which it didn't have anything to do with them, ways in which this predated the involvement of these figures from the campaign. And it clearly had nothing to do with. And that was sort of the straight report, was what happened. There was this indictment day. Tell us what happened. It was all about the White House framing and reaction of it. An hour later, he appears on Shep Smith's show. Now, Shep Smith, is sort of an hour of sanity on Fox. And it's relatively straight ahead news coverage. And the same correspondent from the White House, John Roberts, gave a very straightforward report that really could have appeared on CNN about the gravity of the circumstances for the Trump administration, for people involved with the campaign, and concerns about whether or not not simply did the Russians act to disrupt and to influence our elections, but whether they did so with the knowledge and even with the involvement and encouragement of folks in the Trump campaign itself.
Yeah, and then you have Sean Hannity, which goes even further. I mean, he just says flat out that there's some collusion on the part of Robert Mueller himself, calling into question Mueller's credibility, and the Wall Street Journal editorial page doing the same thing. What do you think that's about, and where is that coming from?
Well, a couple things. It's always great to hear the law and order advocate Sean Hannity worried about due process and the presumption of innocence and the like for figures who come into the sights of a prosecutor. I think it's worth pointing out that the Wall Street Journal and Fox News are both controlled and effectively owned by the Murdoch family, led by Rupert Murdoch. The New York Post has also swung to a hard position questioning the credibility of Robert Mueller, the special counsel who was hailed by figures on both sides when he was named after the firing, the astonishing act from earlier this year of the head of the FBI, James Comey, who had been, of course, overseeing all of this stuff. So, you know, you're seeing the Wall Street Journal and the Murdoch, at least the editorial page and the Murdoch media outlets really throw their lot behind Donald Trump at a time of potential crisis. I mean, this is under any other presidential administration, this is full crisis. Part of the problem is we've become inured to the sense of crisis because there's been so many seeming scandals, so many seeming defining moments, so many seeming disruptions. And the president himself has worked, I think, assiduously to at once create some of those seeming crises and at the same time to undercut the standing of those to challenge him. I think you've seen Fox and the Wall Street Journal and other very conservative outlets try to undermine the authority of Robert Mueller to perhaps lay the groundwork so that if President Trump were to decide at some point to have him dismissed, that they would be able to say, well, you know, we've had reservations and this stuff should happen. That is, that this is a figure who doesn't deserve our respect. You shouldn't allow the proceedings to go forward if they look like they might threaten the administration, its viability, and its credibility.
Mm. Now, you've written a book on Murdoch's world. In fact, it's called Murdoch's World. And so I guess I'm just wondering, because there have been no shortage of reports of Rupert Murdoch personally disliking Donald Trump and not wanting him to be president during the primaries. Why is he marshaling his news organizations in support of him so vociferously?
Well, there are a couple things going on. First, you're absolutely right. I would argue that Trump was probably about 16th or 17th out of the top 17 Republican candidates. This one emerged. Trump, you know, led in the Republican primary for all but 3 days in the polls, give or take. And Trump came, Murdoch came to it somewhat reluctantly and then embraced him. And you see a lineup up and down. Their major primetime figures, Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, the newest addition, could not be stronger supporters of the president if you try. And in fact, the president is on the phone a lot with figures from Fox. They're almost like a shadow cabinet for him, who probably are more influential in his thinking than his actual cabinet. So that's one thing to think. The second thing is that Murdoch both has access to the president himself in a way that he's always had with prime ministers in Britain and his native Australia, but never fully had here. He's able to get the president's ear fairly frequently, has visited with him down at the White House. He's able to counsel him on things. And let's also remember, he has a number of big business things in front of the White House, as well as his competitors having things that he might want to slow down. He helped to counsel the president on his pick to head the Federal Communications Commission. He has wanted the president to slow down in some ways the ability of AT&T to acquire and absorb Time Warner, which he had long wanted and has long reviled. There are a lot of different things in play from a business standpoint that, that Murdoch wants to influence, and he feels he can do that much more easily by having the president's ear than not. I think this is a confluence of interest for Rupert Murdoch rather than what we might see journalistically as a conflict of interest.
And do you think that he is on the phone calling up the journalists and the show hosts at Fox or at the Wall Street Journal and saying, this is how I want you to cover this?
The president of the United States or
no,
Murdoch?
No, Murdoch.
I don't think so much. I think Murdoch personally is overseeing Fox News in the wake of the dismissal of the late Roger Ailes. And he is involved in setting a tone. I don't doubt that they turned to him to say, hey, how do you feel about this, to make sure that the theme of the day or the theme of the week is okay. I think something like attacking Mueller, you know, I don't think they do that without Murdoch being okay with it. I think, though, the amazing thing is Donald Trump himself is on the phone with Tucker Carlson, with Laura Ingraham, with Sean Hannity, with folks on the Fox and Friends in the morning, and with other figures as well. Kimberly Guilfoyle, he used to talk a lot with Eric Bolling, who was dismissed earlier this year after allegations of sexual harassment. He himself in some ways is executive producing his own coverage on Fox News. And that's why, even though we're thinking larger about the global coverage of this moment of scandal, you know, it is not incidental that we're thinking about Fox News, which, and with the larger Murdoch media empire, Fox in particular having such a hold on the Republican lawmakers in Congress, and their fear that if their site, you know, they get targeted by Fox as somehow soft, that voters will come after them, and having, you know, that same outlet having a purchase on certain sector of the Republican electorate that very faithfully votes in primaries.
David, thank you.
You bet.
That's David Folkenflik. He's media correspondent for NPR and author of the book Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. Coming up, pizza, beer, and coffee. Once humble food staples, now signs of gentrification.
Oh, really?
When
you're supporting gentrifying establishments, you're not standing with the same community you're saying that you're from and you're living from. Oh, no, because if you did, you would make conscious decisions as simple as where you buy a cup of coffee.
Our series, There Goes the Neighborhood, continues next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand with a little word association exercise. What do these things have in common? Coffee, pizza, and beer. Well, they're all delicious and all good in moderation, I guess. And they are all signs of gentrification, or at least certain kinds of coffee, pizza, and beer are signs of gentrification.
We don't need more coffee shops because we've seen it all already. There's a lot of shops opening up and they're raising up prices. A lot of these people, they come in and then they'll rack up the prices, and then when stuff like this comes out, it starts pushing out little businesses out of the way, which isn't fair for us. They're not there for the community, they're there for themselves to make money.
Word travels fast nowadays with Instagram, but everyone loves like their local community little hangout, and I feel like this provided that for our neighborhood.
I think there's always going to be people that, you know, they've lived in a neighborhood, it's been a certain way their whole lives, and they're gonna be a little bit resistant to that change. So, yeah, of course, but we do everything that we can to make people in this community especially feel welcome here.
Even other businesses that started out on the weekends are now going into full-time, year-round business because the traffic's there.
Clearly, this is right in the middle of an area which has been traditionally Latino that is growing in its diversity. And so I think they made a very brilliant move in moving here because they're getting both an existing customer base as well as a new evolving customer base.
There Goes the Neighborhood, our series on housing and gentrification, features KCRW's Anna Scott and Saul Gonzalez.
Hey, Anna, can we play a little guessing game?
Okay.
I'm going to name a couple of places. You tell me the one that says gentrification to you.
Okay.
All right. Baskin-Robbins 31 flavors or salt and straw ice cream?
Salt and straw.
24-hour fitness or namaste yoga? By the way, am I saying namaste right?
I think so.
Okay, go on.
Namaste yoga.
TGI Fridays or a restaurant called Forage?
Obviously Forage.
obviously. Yeah, it's not a hard game, I know. The point is, gentrification is so tied to neighborhood commerce, where we shop, where we eat, and where we hang out. And when swankier businesses open in a neighborhood, they might make the people who already live there feel uncomfortable, leaving the impression those stores and restaurants and what they're selling isn't really for them.
Yeah, people can feel a kind of retail alienation, like this woman who talked to our producer, Miguel Contreras.
La mayoría somos gente de clase trabajadora. Y los negocios a nosotros no nos afecta ni nos beneficia.
That's Flor Ventura. She lives in LA's rapidly gentrifying Highland Park neighborhood. She said that most of the people around here are still working class, but that the newer businesses opening in Highland Park don't help them because they're just too expensive.
Yo acostumbraba ir a una frutería que daban todo como a $3.
She just said that the fruit stand she used to go to, that they raised the price of fresh squeezed juice from $3 to $5. And then I asked her who all the new places are for.
¿Y quiénes son?
Los hipsters.
Los hipsters. No translation needed.
I'm Saul Gonzalez, and this is There Goes the Neighborhood LA. In this show, the merchants of gentrification. We'll sample coffee, pizza, and beer.
A suspect is caught on camera vandalizing a new coffee shop in Boyle Heights. Now, tonight, the owner believes that crime was a warning.
Yeah, many people in the area say new businesses are coming in and driving up the rent for everyone.
In our last show, we told you about a backlash against art galleries in this same neighborhood, Boyle Heights. When a new coffee house opened here a couple of months back, the backlash widened. Activists marched in front of the business, and arguments broke out on the street between customers and protesters.
Oh, really? When you're supporting gentrifying establishments, you're not standing with the same community you're saying that you're from and you're living from. Oh, no, because if you did, you would make conscious decisions as simple as where you buy a cup of coffee. Where you buy a coffee matters. Where you're putting your money in our community.
Why the passion over a single little business opening? Well, coffee houses, especially the kind selling single-origin beans and almond milk cappuccinos, they've become the cliched symbols of gentrification. But who are these people selling us our fancy lattes? And what does it look like from their side of the counter?
I'll get a macchiato.
Okay. Any nibbles today?
No, not today.
This coffee house in LA's Glassell Park neighborhood just opened 3 months ago. It's called Little Ripper, Australian slang.
A Little Ripper is it's a good little thing. You can yell it out when your team kicks the winning goal, or you can tell a kid he's a little ripper. Yeah, he's a good little thing.
That's Rex Roberts and Lorena Jurado, the married couple who own Little Ripper and also live in the neighborhood. Rex is originally from Melbourne, Lorena from Quito, Ecuador, and this is their first small business together.
Oh my God, it's been amazing. I mean, hard work. Absolutely hard work. We're exhausted.
Although super gentrified places like Highland Park and Silver Lake are close, this middle and working class neighborhood of apartments and single family homes hasn't really seen a lot of new businesses open. Even as young professional families who are great potential customers have been moving into the area. Many locals who walk over from their homes say they were thirsty for this kind of neighborhood hangout. As she waits for her order, I meet Adrian Leon, who lives in the neighborhood.
Do you think a coffee house kind of sends a message that, yeah, the neighborhood's a bit more on the map now, you know?
Definitely. And this place looks totally trendy. It's very different from some of the other small businesses around. I mean, on this block mainly, there's multiple car repair shops. But it's nothing that you want to, like, go and hang out in that didn't really exist before. So this is nice where we can just get to meet our neighbors, which we've met so many more neighbors than before.
And I know how she feels, because this is my neighborhood. And as a lover of coffee houses, I, too, am delighted Little Ripper is here.
I'm going to try one of the English muffins and a 12-ounce black coffee.
And Little Ripper is cool looking. Gleaming white walls, a counter area inlaid with subway tiles, freshly baked pastries on display behind glass. But Lorena and Rex say they went through financial hell to create all this charm.
That was probably the hardest, because you're literally bleeding money.
you know, it's all my savings, my 401k, my pension, everything's here, and just to be hit with, here you go, you have to pay another fee, you have to pay another permit.
When they spent all their own money, they turned to Kickstarter, raising over $16,000. A lot of that from locals who really wanted to see the coffee house in the neighborhood.
So if I had, like, put in some dough into your Kickstarter campaign, what were some of the things I would have gotten back?
You get a
couple of free coffees, you get a hat, you get a slap on the back and a big thank you and a hug every time you walked in the door.
So get a lot of respect and appreciation in return for your Kickstarter dough.
Absolutely, yeah.
Since it opened, business has boomed at Little Ripper, partly because of word of mouth and a carefully curated Instagram page. Rex and Lorena know that a coffee house like theirs might leave a bad taste in some people's mouths as too trendy or a stalking horse for gentrification. Lorena has little patience for that criticism.
I'm going to be honest here. What about the Starbucks? What about the McDonald's? And what about the big chain places? What do you say when those places come into your community? I think supporting a mom and pop shop and supporting a small little business is better than supporting a Starbucks and supporting a big corporation. So I think that's the missing point.
That you are human scaled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're a small business. We're just trying to make it. We live in the area. We want to better it. And yeah, I think that's the missing point.
It's not super controversial to open a new business in a neighborhood like this corner of Glassell Park, which is still kind of sleepy. The spot where Little Ripper sits was empty before Lorena and Rex got there. But it can be a very different story when a new business replaces an old one. Next up, KCRW's Anna Scott takes us out to eat in Echo Park with a story of battling pizzerias and what it means to be authentically of the neighborhood.
If businesses are like barometers of neighborhood change, the ones in Echo Park show a community split between old and new. Along Sunset Boulevard, you see the new Lassen's health food store across from the old Guadalupana Market and the expensive Woodcat coffee shop beside the old Botanica selling herbal remedies, incense, and candles. Right now, I'm sitting outside near Sunset and Alvarado Street with Israel Palacios. He's 37 years old. And for more than 20 years, his family owned a pizza restaurant up the block from here, Pizza Bona.
I have a lot of customers that have traveled the world and whatnot, even from New York, that say that the pizza is just incredible.
Pizza Bona was cozy and kitschy, with wood-paneled walls and Frank Sinatra on the jukebox.
Am I making up that there were, like, red checkered tablecloths?
That's a cliche. We actually had kind of, like, off-green. We had white. We had beige. We had different tables. But we never had the checkered.
Two old Pizza Bona signs still hang on the building. They're red with white letters spelling out pizza. The Bona has been covered up because over the summer, a new pizzeria opened there, Cosa Bona. It's run by local celebrity chef Zach Pollock. Cosa Bona serves a fancier pie topped with local cheeses and pepperoni shipped in from the East Coast. Israel hates the sight of it.
Instead of being happy at looking at my old place or what it's become, a lot of times when I drive by, sometimes I don't look. It's just upsetting, to say the least.
It's the name that really makes him angry.
You know, he's trying to fool people. Had he gone a different route, Italian food, a different name, I would have been in there. The first person been in there introduced myself and said, "Hey, man, I'm Israel. Nice to meet you. I grew up in this building. Let me see what you've done. It's a great place. We probably could have been friends."
Now, it does not look like that's going to happen. Rising rent drove Pizza Bona out. It more than doubled in 2 years.
What they wanted me to pay was $7,500 from $3,500. They raised it to $5,000 and then $5,500. And then by 2 years, it was going to be $7,500.
Israel's landlords, two cousins who have owned the building for decades, didn't want to be interviewed.
At the end of the day, it's not something that, it wasn't something that we could not afford. We could have. The question was the building worth it at that price? And the simple answer is no.
So Pizza Bona closed at the end of 2015. But last year it reopened. Israel found a new space, half a block from the old one. It's a tiny shop hidden away in a strip mall, but the price is right.
It's not what I wanted. It's not what I'm used to. But at that time, it was 6 months without people, you know, with my food, so to speak. And by the time I opened, it was 9.5 months. So you wait any longer, people start forgetting about you, regardless of the history.
Even though his own business is still alive and well, Israel believes Cosabona stole something from him.
You know, gentrification is going to happen regardless where you go. It's either you keep up with the times or you get left behind. Simple. But as far as what the other guys take into my old spot, it's unoriginal. The way he was raised is very different from the way I was raised. Completely different. I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I had to work for everything I have, and I still work.
Israel doesn't know Zach Pollock, but he believes he lacks authenticity, an idea that comes up a lot in relation to gentrification. When a new business opens in a changing neighborhood, there can be a fine line between fitting in with the old and appropriating it.
Next up, the pizza maker across the street says his piece, and we have a gentrification taste test.
All right, we'll have more of our series, There Goes the Neighborhood, when Press Play continues. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going back to our series about housing and gentrification, There Goes the Neighborhood. Here's KCRW's Saul Gonzalez and Anna Scott.
This food fight that you've been listening to reflects a bigger phenomenon. It's getting harder for anyone to keep a mom-and-pop business going here in Los Angeles. When I meet Zach Pollock after the lunch rush one day at Cosabona, he brings this up.
You do see a lot more big capital pouring in, especially as retail becomes less and less relevant with most of it moving online. You see a lot more interest from big money in restaurants.
In fact, there's a brand new shopping center right next door to Cosabona. It's leased to a bunch of chains that are supposed to move in soon. A Starbucks, a Chipotle, the Habit Burger Grill, and a vegan cinnamon roll franchise. Cosabona's landlords actually got an offer to sell out to that developer, but said no. So Zach argues they deserve some credit for keeping the place an independently owned pizzeria, even if it's a more upscale one. As for Pizzabona...
There's, you know, some angry online narratives where, like, I'm like an evil developer and I came in and, you know, physically pushed Pizzabona out and then took it for myself. No, in my opinion, nothing could be further from the truth.
I mean, you probably know that the owner of Pizzabona is pissed about the sign. Basically, his take is that by leaving it up, you're kind of riding off of his loyal customer base from so many years. So I just wonder what you say to that.
When I took over the lease here, I had no idea. This was in December of 2015. We were mostly built out when all of a sudden they reopened across the street. I didn't think they were reopening. So I like the signs because they sort of, they've been here for a long time. They have become kind of, I mean, they're not technically historical, but kind of like a symbol of the neighborhood.
To Israel, they're a symbol of a neighborhood that feels less welcoming than it once did. To Zach, the signs are a tribute. He says he didn't know the two restaurants would end up so close together.
Had I known that they were going to open across the street, would I have kept the name Cosabona? I don't know. I definitely would have thought more about it. I love places like that. I love Columbo's in Eagle Rock. I love Damon's in Glendale. The last thing I want to do is like step on the feet of the people before me.
Columbo's and Damon's are both longtime neighborhood restaurants that haven't changed much over the years. Zach's restaurants are flashier, trendier, and yeah, he's not surprised that Cosabona's been pointed to as an example of gentrification.
I mean, I'd have to be like living in a hole to not expect it at some level.
But he doesn't quite know what to do with that.
I'm a chef first and foremost. You know, I'm not a developer. I'm way underfunded to be developing anything. So, you know, my focus is on the food and by association, the experience of dining. And, you know, if that experience is a reflection of myself, and I guess I as a younger person that didn't live in Echo Park on the east side until 4 years ago, sure, I understand that I'm wrapped up in it in a way, but it's a tricky one.
I asked him if he's tried Pizzabona's food.
I'm not going there. No, I've tried it. I'm not saying I'm not going to the Pizzabona. I'm saying I'm not going into that question.
Israel says he hasn't tried Cosabona.
I don't need to. My food speaks for itself. But you put my food up against his any day, and you'll be coming to mine.
Okay, we'll see about that. I rounded up Saul and Miguel for a pizza taste test at Echo Park Lake. We got two margarita pies, one from Pizza Bona and one from Cosa Bona.
Just to set the base, we all like pizza?
Yes.
I love pizza.
But who doesn't, right? I mean, yeah.
One thing that's obvious as soon as we open the boxes is that the Cosa Bona pizza is much thinner and lighter.
I think maybe the fancy one's like once every 3-4 weeks.
It's a little more refined.
It cost $14.50, and I could have eaten the whole thing myself.
The old school one is, you know, buy like four of them for a party. Yeah.
The Pizza Bona one cost $18 and could have fed 4 people.
It's like straight up comfort food.
Saul takes a bite of each.
I hate to be Switzerland here. I would happily eat either one of them.
They're different in exactly the way that you would expect them to be different. It almost seems wrong to compare them, really, because they're just very different pizzas. And you would hope that you could have both in the neighborhood.
For now, Echo Park does have both. In fact, Israel says even though he's in a smaller space, Pizza Bona is doing better than ever thanks to an increase in takeout orders. He might hate what Cosa Bona represents, but so far it hasn't hurt business.
Okay, we've had the coffee, we've had the pizza, now time for beer. You're going to hear from two entrepreneurs going from making lagers and pale ales in their apartment to running a brewery. But for their business to prosper, they're counting on a ton of investment, public and private, to revive an L.A. landmark. I'm standing on the banks of the Los Angeles River in L.A.'s Elysian Valley neighborhood, watching a predator on the hunt.
So what kind of bird is that?
It's an osprey.
And what's it doing?
It's looking for fish. It's a fish-eating bird of prey.
That's historian Wade Graham. He writes a lot about cities and the environment, including Los Angeles' ambivalent relationship with the river.
We tend to look at the river as a kind of a failure or an eyesore or an embarrassment. So people used to say, well, you know what the signature wildlife species of the Los Angeles River is, don't you? It's a shopping cart.
For most of LA history, the river could also be a menace, topping its banks during heavy rains and flooding neighborhoods. So, in the 1930s, concrete was poured along its sides and bottom, and the LA River was turned into what it is today, essentially a 50-mile-long storm drain emptying into the Pacific.
They took a chaotic, violent, natural system that was unsuited to the aspirations of the city fathers, and they turned it into something that allowed those aspirations, that allowed 4 million people to settle in its floodplain. So, as a designed object, it has performed beautifully.
They tamed it.
Well, they killed it.
Now there are plans underway, big plans, to bring the LA River back to life, starting along this stretch of it through Elysian Valley, also known to locals as Frogtown. Along this 11-mile span of the waterway, the river's bottom was never paved over, and it still looks like a river. There are willow trees growing on small islands populated by egrets and ospreys, and in the water, there's carp and bass. A few years ago, a bike path and pocket parks were put in along its banks, and now there's even summer kayak racing.
Gibson, go!
Looking ahead, officials want to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on river restoration, and star architect Frank Gehry has been tapped to help provide a vision. This effort is usually cast in environmental terms, ripping out the concrete and returning the LA River to a more natural state. But in a city where development is exploding, Wade sees other forces at play.
Waterfronts are money. Rotterdam, Tokyo, New York City, Chicago. This is true everywhere. And we neglected ours for too long.
But the money can still be made here.
There is a gold rush going on.
And the first prospectors in that gold rush are a string of small businesses that have opened along this stretch of the LA River. A Mexican restaurant serving gourmet tacos, a coffee house, of course, and two guys who are here to brew some beer.
Do those barrels go right to the taps?
Those go right to the taps. So we serve right directly from our cold room to the other side of the wall is the taps, yeah.
So the other side of this wall.
It's Frogtown Brewery, an artisanal beer maker and tap room.
My favorite beer on tap right now is a beer called Hazy River. It's a New England-style IPA, so it's going to be hazy, but it's going to be really juicy and fruit-forward.
That's Adam Kestel. Last year, he and his business partner, Mike Voss, who were both home brewers, opened this business. It's on an industrial street that dead ends at the river. They say plans to revive the river and make it into a regional destination are key to their own success.
I think it's critically important. I mean, I think that's part of the reason that drew us to this area is all the things that are happening with the LA River. And most of the customers that are here this morning are people who are running or biking along the bike path this morning. So I think it's critical to our business.
Their cavernous brewery is a reminder of the riverfront's grittier days.
Oh, this place before was a manufacturing business, and they made life-size sex dolls. Right where you're standing is where they would be painting a sex doll. And the cool thing is that you could actually come in and have yourself 3D scanned and have a exact replica. I mean, these guys are really good. Exact replica of yourself made.
Away from its industrial zone, Elysian Valley is a largely Latino and blue-collar community, its residents living in modest single-family stucco homes. Nestled between the I-5 freeway on one side and the river on the other, outsiders overlooked the neighborhood for decades. Some residents wish they could go back to those days. Elena Lovelace is one of them. She grew up in the neighborhood.
I'm fighting the gentrification. I'm fighting all these businesses that are involved in the neighborhood. At least, you know, I need to fight it. I need to slow it down. I can't give up. I just can't.
And Elena has special contempt for outsiders who use the word Frogtown for Elysian Valley, like Adam and Mike back at Frogtown Brewery. Elena feels the same way as Israel, the owner of Pizza Bona. Newcomers are coming in and appropriating what was there before.
It pisses me off because that is a name that a lot of the longtime residents came up with many, many years ago when we had tons of frogs in the neighborhood, little, you know, actual frogs coming from the river. And now all of a sudden, all these gentrifiers, all these people that are coming from different areas are making money off that name. And they don't really know the meaning of that name. They don't know where it came from or what it meant.
Mike and Adam, they say they owe no one an apology for naming their business Frogtown.
It's a cool name. And there's a lot of history behind it, like many names. And we thought, you know what, we can live up to this. We can make something of Frogtown Brewery that the neighborhood will be proud of.
As plans move ahead to improve the LA River, more businesses are following the brewery into Elysian Valley, from restaurants to a big live-work complex. Remember Wade Graham's line, "Waterfronts are money."
From the beginning, the Los Angeles River has been a real estate phenomenon, as well as a hydrologic phenomenon and a biological phenomenon and a political phenomenon and an engineering phenomenon. And it remains a real estate phenomenon. And if you look around you, that's what's happening in the city right now, particularly in this part of the city right now. It's changing under our feet, all around us, really fast.
Adam and Mike, well, they plan on doubling their manufacturing capacity in the coming weeks. And they soon expect to sell their beer in supermarkets and bars around L.A., spreading the name of Frogtown far and wide.
Okay, what's your experience with gentrification in LA? Is it happening where you live? Is that good? Is it bad? Is it a bit of both? We want to hear about it. We're at KCRW Press Play on Facebook and Twitter, and you can get this whole series as a podcast at Apple, at iTunes, or kcrw.com. Next week, we'll talk about the high cost of housing. Who can afford to move to LA these days? We'll find out next Tuesday on our series, There Goes the Neighborhood. All right. So before we leave you today, a local angle on the Trump-Russia Manafort saga. And by local, we mean Beverly Hills, Rodeo Drive specifically. According to the indictment, Paul Manafort spent more than $500,000 at an unnamed clothing store in Beverly Hills over the course of 6 years, including more than $128,000 in a single purchase. Well, the store manager has neither confirmed nor denied this theory, but if one wanted to drop that much cash on menswear and drop it fast, House of Bijan would probably be your first stop. Here's the 25-year-old Nicholas Bijan giving a tour of his boutique.
You know, this is a beautiful jacket in kangaroo skin, and this is all very soft leather.
And next to that kangaroo suit, a portrait of Bijan Sr. with one of his favorite customers, George H.W. Bush, the former president. Other rich and famous clients have included Vladimir Putin and the Shah of Iran. Amy Feldman has stopped by as well. She wrote about the House of Bijan for Forbes magazine.
It's by appointment only. You ring the bell, you go in. It's a bright yellow store. There's original art on the walls. There's a giant chandelier made out of Bijan perfume bottles and a big staircase going up. It's grand and sort of over the top.
Over the top. A place where you could spend $25,000 on one suit.
You could. The starting price for the suits is about $10,000, and their best customers spend $100,000, and even the very, very best customers can spend $1 million.
On one suit?
Not on one suit, at one time.
Okay.
You could buy 10 suits and spend, you know, $250,000 with no problem. So they've had clientele from, like, you know, all of the politicians to Los Angeles billionaire property developer Rick Caruso to the actor Jaime Camille. He plays Rogelio de la Vega on Jane the Virgin.
Okay. And he makes enough money to afford a suit.
He makes enough money to afford it, to afford a suit. And so he talked about buying this cashmere peacoat that had a retail price of $18,000. And that's sort of, you know, the type of thing that you could buy at Bijan. It's a place where a tie will cost you $950.
So it's known for its yellow Bugatti outside. Is that like a
it is,
card?
Yes. The yellow Bugatti is outside, and the walls in the store are also painted yellow.
Uh-huh. So Bijan, he founded it in the early 70s. He was an Iranian immigrant. He died a few years ago. I guess this Bugatti was his idea. The whole thing was his idea? This was his vision?
That's correct. So Bijan immigrated here. He came to L.A., and he set up this store on Rodeo Drive. And it was one of the first stores there when that area wasn't the shopping mecca that it is today, and the Bijan store sort of helped create this mecca as it is now.
Well, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on. This was fun.
That's Amy Feldman. She's a writer at Forbes. Here's someone who regularly shops at Bijan, Christian Berdahl.
You know, I find it very hard, Madeline, to spend my $1.4 million on men's clothes. It's not easy, you know?
I know.
I find that the undies with the gold thread, they're kind of droopy. You know, they don't do well in the rinse cycle. Enough of that. Earlier we talked about big social media companies testifying before Congress. And something like 126 million users seeing fake Russia agent ads. Ask listeners how they figure out what's real, what's not. Glenn Searle says, let's rename social media social propaganda. Sonia Lucchini says, is there some document available to the public that shows all the fake posts so we can see what to avoid in the future? And you know, I've looked around, there are a few pieces out there that name a few of the posts, but I think that's a really interesting idea. Wouldn't it be nice to see like all of these posts that came from Russian propagandists? I'd be kind of fascinated.
I know. How would you know though? That's the whole point.
Well, Facebook, aren't they supposed to know?
I guess. Yeah. Well, so they say. All right. So Christian Berdahl, thank you so much. Enjoy your kangaroo skin suit.
Thank you.
I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.